Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and I'm joined tonight by Alan Bryan. Say hello.
How you doing?
And Bill Reynolds, here filling in for
Howdy.
Kyle Kafer. So tonight is going to be one of our deep dives, and we're covering a landmark, a real classic. And the name of that show, of course, is Perry Mason. So, Alan, since this is really your favorite show, why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit about why this show means so much to you?
Well, it's one of the first shows I got interested in as a kid. Now, I know that sounds strange. Now, really, the first one that hit me as a kid when I was, it was six and Batman was premiering, but this was, by the time I got into this, it was on reruns on WGN Channel 9 in the Chicago region. It was showing five nights a week on Channel 9 at 9 p.m. And when other shows were reruns, or if there wasn't a 9 p.m. show to watch on regular network TV, remember there were only three networks back then, we'd flip over to Channel 9 and catch a rerun of Perry Mason. And I did that a lot. I fell in love with the show at an early age. And, you know, it's one that I don't care what episode is showing, I can watch it. And I do. And that's just how it goes with me. And it's been my, you know, I mean, there's the other show that is very close, you know, to the number one spot is the Avengers, the British Avengers. But this one is, if you go by older shows, this is it. This is number one, and I'm nuts about it. So, you know, I did a binge watch of the entire series 3 years ago. I've seen all the movies, and it's all available on Kindle. There's a very large book. It's a comprehensive book that covers the movies, the paperback novels, well, the novels that were big hits in the 50s and paperback, and then the TV series, and then the revival of Raymond Burr's series as movies, touching a little bit on the brief Monty Markham revival. I don't care for that. But it's part of my growing up. It's part of my adulthood. I've got the whole thing on DVD, and, you know, I can pull out a season anytime I want. What I got good for when it would catch a rerun on TV, we would watch an episode, and I would be able to guess the season the way Perry did his hair and maybe his size. He would slightly change his hairstyle a little bit, and, you know, or maybe look a little heavier, and I'd say, oh, that's season four. Oh, that's season six. You know, and that's really crazy. And then, you know, there were my favorite shticking about the show, and I'll let Bill talk now, and, you know, and I'm going to back off for a minute before I run my voice.
So, Bill, how did you come to the show?
Well, being older than you guys, my parents and I watched it first run on Saturday nights. You know, Saturday nights was always Perry Mason, and Sunday nights was always Ed Sullivan. You know, and Thursday was You Bet Your Life. So I watched it from the get-go. I liked it a lot when I was watching it. I guess what? It came on in 59, so it would have been about 10. Even at 10 years old, it struck me at that time as being a little formulaic. I mean, I developed this theory within a few years that whoever Mason was interrogating, you know, on the witness stand at precisely 5 minutes before the show ended was the guilty party. So I liked it, watching it as a kid. I didn't love it. But then they started reruns on MeTV, and, you know, at like 7 in the morning and 8 in the morning, they'd like run 2 episodes in a row. And I started, you know, watching it. I hadn't seen it in the interim. I hadn't ever watched it on reruns. And watching it again on MeTV, I became fascinated with it, and I liked it a lot better than when I'd been a kid. It was in many ways very formulaic, but they played with the formula in subtle ways. You know, as we said, there was the thing in season 6 where he got replaced for 4 episodes because he was having some kind of surgery. And I have to say, the second one of those was Michael Rennie. And I remember seeing that when I was a kid because I just went out of my mind because I was a huge fan of Michael Rennie, not from The Day the Earth Stood Still, which I had not seen at that point, but from the series The Third Man, where he plays a Harry Lime that's kind of more like a Simon Templar character than the evil bastard of the movie. You know, and then there was the episode where Mason played 2 roles. He played this drifter dock worker who was a doppelganger for Mason himself, and was used to, I think, frame Mason for something or other. So they're just, you know, they played with it in very, very subtle ways that just, you know, enthralled me when I rewatched the series, because they, you know, they had a formula, they had to stick to it, but within those constraints, they exercised a tremendous amount of creativity, and that always impresses me. I mean, somebody like, you know, a wild director, you know, a David Lynch, say, and I say this as somebody who likes David Lynch, but there's no constraints on David Lynch, so he can do the wildest stuff possible, you know, but it also impresses me to see someone being creative in, you know, within a very narrowly constrained format. I also watched, I think MeTV showed these after each cycle of the original series. It cycled through like 4 or 5 times, and I kept watching the same episodes over and over again. I hated the color movie series because it was the original show. You know, when I was watching it at 10 years old, I didn't know what the hell noir was. But watching it on MeTV, it became obvious it was one of the most noir shows on television. You know,
absolutely.
It was very claustrophobic. You know, it was great that it was in black and white. And the TV movies were just like, to me, were just like typical 80s TV movies, you know, with a lot of car chases.
They were Matlock with Perry Mason.
Pardon?
They were Matlock with Perry Mason.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the characters were still great, but it lost a lot of the atmosphere that had made the original 9 seasons so exceptional. So that's how I came across it. I came across it twice, once in real time and once on MeTV.
Yeah. Well, I will say that for me, I had relatives when I was little, back in the 80s and 90s, because I'm 39, and they would watch Perry Mason reruns, and they'd watch the movies once they started coming on. And I always thought it was a really good show, very well made, absolutely nothing to really complain about with it. But as I've gotten older and occasionally returned to an episode here or there, they're just so tightly constructed every single episode. Sometimes they might be a little too tightly constructed, but, you know, that's not much of a complaint.
And your point, Bill, about how noir it was, that's absolutely true. I mean, I watched about a dozen, maybe 15 episodes in my run up to this, and there's a bunch of episodes that just scream noir. I forget exactly which episode it was, but there's this one, and I believe it's the one that was originally, maybe you know which one I'm talking about, Alan, but it's the one that was originally shot as the pilot, but it didn't go out as the pilot, and it hardly has any court cases in it at all. It's mostly Perry and Paul going around investigating, and there's this scene in a hotel room with a message done in lipstick underneath the tabletop. Do you know that one I'm talking about, Alan?
Vaguely, yes. I'm trying to remember the title of it right now, and I may come up with it in a moment.
If it helps, I want to say it might have been directed by Victor McLaughlin. But, yeah, you know, the thing is this is a show that did get some really special guests directors. It also was one of only two series, I believe, at the time to be produced by a woman. In this case, Gail Patrick Jackson, who was the wife of Earl Stanley Gardner's agent, and an actress and producer in her own right. So, you know, she apparently really went to bat for some of these people.
It was also the first hour drama, period. Up to that show, up to this time, no show. No, there wasn't any other. Gunsmoke went to an hour later on, but there had been no one-hour show. So this is your first hour-long drama.
And that's right. Most of the dramas in that period were half hour.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sea Hunt, for instance, was a half hour.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and I know that I was reading up on it as part of my research for tonight, and apparently the producer of the show said, you know, CBS wanted us to do it as a one-hour live production, and I said, no way. Whoever we cast as Perry, that's going to kill him.
Christian Nyby directed a lot of the first season.
Nice.
And I was always thrilled when I saw Victor Buono on it. I mean, I think he played four or five different characters in four or five different episodes.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, and
it really was a wealth of character actors.
Oh, yeah, and not just character actors from television and the movies, but also people who'd done radio, because Raymond Burr came up in Los Angeles radio.
Right.
He brought along a lot of his coworkers and buddies. But, no, it's got a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stuff. I mean, of course, you know, we all know that Hopper's mother was Hedda Hopper, and apparently he almost didn't take the part because he said, wait, I know you. You don't like my mother. And the producer said, it's not so much that I don't like her. I don't hate your mother. I just strongly disagree with a lot of what she stands for.
As do I.
But, there's just so many great behind-the-scenes stories, and I did want to get to some of those. The soap opera Edge of Night started off as the original development for Perry Mason. Yep. And apparently they almost cast Fred McMurray, but they just couldn't afford him.
Yeah, I think I read that somewhere.
Frederick Murray was a very difficult actor when it came to television, so I don't think he would have worked out very well.
Yep. Now, do either of you know the story?
It's impossible to imagine anyone but Raymond Burr in the part at this juncture.
Oh, the thing is Raymond Burr, you know, you see him and you think, oh, yeah, that's Perry Mason. Hell, you just hear the music, the first couple notes, and you immediately see his face.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In the early episodes, they were adapting a lot of what Earl Stanley Gardner had written, and then I'm guessing in the third season they kind of were in danger of running out, so they started doing original screenplays. And when I was rewatching it on MeTV, you know, I was always very interested to see whether it said based on a story by Earl Stanley Gardner or based on characters by Earl Stanley Gardner. And I tried to determine if I thought that the ones based on actual texts were better, but I could never come to that conclusion. I thought some of the original scripts were just as good.
Yeah, I think it's a very tightly scripted series.
Well,
but,
Well, I want to interject here. Gardner had final say on every script.
I didn't know that. Cool.
You know, I mean, yes. Well, that's in the Perry Mason book. Like I say, it's on Kindle. In that book, the author explains that Gardner it was his word, or, you know, he would review every script, and if he didn't like little bits, now, his control lessened a little bit in the last couple seasons, but for the most part, every script got reviewed by Mr. Gardner, and he would, you know, say whether or not it could be filmed. He did not want, you know, something to go out there without him knowing exactly what was happening.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is down to the influence of Gail Jackson and her husband, because, as I said, you know, she was definitely fully in charge of the show, but she'd known Earl Stanley Gardner because of her husband being his agent, and she considered him a close friend and an important voice in American literature. I mean, hell, the man was, at the time of his death, he was the most successful American writer of the 20th century in terms of commercial sales.
It's ironic, considering since his books are now virtually out of print, and the old Penguin paperbacks, which I have a lot of, are quite valuable. Now there were a few hardcover reprints of an episode or two a number of years ago, but the majority of books are just not available anymore. They, you know, once the show ended, the interest in the novels went away also.
Yeah, I saw a thing that it knocked me for a loop. It had something like 100 Earl Stanley Gardner novels. It was like some crazy Kindle edition, and they only wanted like $20 for it. I was really tempted to get it a few years back.
Just
to have them.
One of my Facebook friends, Terry Beatty, who writes the Rex Morgan comic strip, was selling a number of the paperbacks, and the condition went from kind of ragged to very, very good. And for $40, I couldn't resist, and I got a bunch of them. So, you know, for me, it was like this, you know, there's a couple there that are too ragged to really read, but the others, you know, you kind of eat them up.
Yep. Now, here's a question. Do either of you know where Bill Tallman got
cast from in Perry Mason as Hamilton Burger?
Yes, I did. I'm trying to remember.
Bill, do you know?
I can't remember.
No, I don't. I know that he was fired by CBS because of some police raid that he was involved in, and then rehired. But I didn't know about how he was hired to begin with.
What happened is
not fired.
He was in a movie. He played the heavy in a movie called The Hitchhiker.
Right.
And
that was an Ida Lupino film. Very good.
Yep.
Very good.
Yeah, it really is. I was just going to say it's from a really great director. The story that I heard, and maybe I've heard it wrong, maybe you could confirm it based on the books you've read, because you've done a lot more reading on it than I have, Alan. The story that I heard about Tallman's suspension / firing from CBS is that everybody on the show wanted to keep him, didn't care, figured it would literally just be a suspension. And CBS was pretty much saying, no, you're going to fire him. And Earl Stanley Gardner himself had to pull his weight in order to prevent CBS from firing him. And the reason that, despite the judge in the case dismissing it as pretty much just a misdemeanor, slap on the wrist, go on, don't do this again, tisk, I understand that he was at some party smoking weed, basically.
Mm-hmm. The party was raided. It was possession of marijuana and lewd vagrancy charges or something along that line. The lewd vagrancy got dumped for lack of proof. Tallman denied using the marijuana. Now, I've read that he was fired. I've also read that he was suspended. But regardless of it, the entire cast wanted him back, and you know they and Burr just insisted. There was a lot of fans wrote in, and they
free internet campaign.
Oh yeah, much. It was a much bigger thing than the Star Trek write-in campaign, but I gotta say the one to get Tallman back, because you know they just want him, and you know Burr was insistent that he come back. I don't know if they would have continued the show without him, but it was one of those things where you know you have to remember this is a time when Robert Mitchum went to jail for marijuana possession in the early 50s. I did a few months in jail for a couple of joints. So, you know, you get busted for marijuana back then, it was like you were, child killer type stuff. They were
serious
really
stuff, right?
Yeah, marijuana, boy, oh my God, oh, evil weed, and and it killed the careers of a lot of people, just as much as being suspected of being gay back then, that would also hurt people.
And of course we all know that Raymond Burr had to remain in the closet.
Very much so.
Virtually his entire life.
Before we get to the TV show, I want to mention the movies in the 30s. When they did the films in the 30s, Gardner wasn't very happy with them because, they didn't follow the structure of the books at all. It was Perry Mason and he was a lawyer, but that's about the extent of it. The movies were B films at best, and they were just not the what Gardner had in mind, and it was when they wanted him to do the show, he was very hesitant again about it, but because he wanted them to be done right, which is why he was doing them, viewing all the scripts, because he got burned from Hollywood in the 30s, and he didn't, you know, and you had Warren William played Perry a number of times, and they're not terrible films by any means, but they don't resemble the TV show very much either.
No.
Right.
So, that says a lot about it. Plus, while you did have Adela, you didn't have a Paul Drake very much. So there was a lot of difference to it. I have some of the movies on DVD. They're fun to watch, but they're not quite the same thing as the TV show, which is 10 times better. So if I can't say they're terrible. Donald Woods played Perry Mason, William Wellman. Trying to remember the other author, the other people. There were a number of different ones, I think, at the time. But it was not. And you also have to remember too, they came after the pre-code era, so they were later 30s. They didn't have. If they'd been pre-code, they might have been better. I don't know. I'm just thinking about it here. Who knows? They could have been. For what you get, if they show up in TCM sometimes, you can buy the Warren ones from Warren Archives, and you can kind of say, oh, what are these like? And you find out they're 30s films, they're crime dramas, but they don't have the feel of the Perry Mason show, that's for sure. So, that's all.
I want to bring something. Oh, go on, Bill.
No, I was just saying I'd be curious to see them. Before we leave Hamilton Burger, I also thought the show was very, very loyal to Lieutenant Trag, because, you know, as Ray Collins became ill, you know, they didn't get rid of him. They used him as much as they could and brought other guys in to like Richard Anderson to support him, to supplement him. But, you know, I always, in both cases, I respected the fact that the series was so loyal to its cast. I'm, above and beyond, I think.
Yeah, I want to get back to the cast bit in a minute here, or for a minute here. Is it just me? Or despite how some people like to say, well, you know, it's a 50s show, women are always just damsels in distress, I think that Perry Mason actually did a pretty good job showing women as having some depth, as having some backbone, and I can't say that that's not due to the influence of its producer.
I was aware of that watching it on MeTV, watching the reruns. I think it portrayed a lot of women with, who had a great deal of agency, for good and sometimes for ill. And also it was, every once in a while watching something, in the morning as a rerun, I'll slap my head and wonder how on earth did Standards and Practices let this go through in 1957.
Oh, yeah. No, there's this one episode where Perry, he asks this woman on the stand, are you a drug user? And brings out a needle and asks her where she injects and why and how. And I'm just like, wait, when was this episode aired?
Right. And there's a lot of, like every third or fourth episode has a couple of an unmarried couple sleeping together.
Oh yeah, I mean, and that's all due to the fact that this show definitely was true to its 30s and 40s pulp roots,
right? And to the, you know, to Gardner texts.
Yep. So I want to ask you guys a question, or a two-part question. First, do you know what the name of that theme song was?
Yes.
No.
Of course.
What was it then, Alan?
Park Avenue Beat.
And do you know what else the composer Fred Steiner was famous for?
I did, and I'm blank. I'm going to blank on it, but, you know.
He composed the theme song for, or the theme music for the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. Yep, and for Star Trek. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did do Rocky and Bullwinkle, yes, and Steiner also contributed to the Star Trek TV show and the motion picture. He was contributing
yep.
for that.
Courage did it, but Steiner did a lot of stuff, and from what I understand, helped. He was the guy that rearranged the theme music for the third season.
He did music for Rawhide and Twilight Zone and Have Gun Will Travel. He was all over television back then and later movies.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something we can talk about a little bit is. Just how many of these faces in front of him, behind the camera, and these names show up in other series and movies of the period. I mean, you know, they talk about 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. What about 6 degrees of Perry Mason?
Oh, of course.
Well, I mentioned Victor Buono before, and this was my intro to him, but. You know, and I was delighted to see him again in the Wild Wild West.
He played Hutton Batman. That's where he really got known. I mean,
I hated Batman, so I didn't see that.
Well, he was King Tut, which I didn't like the character because that was a villain created for Batman at the time for the series. But he did it with. He was good at it. I can give you that. So, if that's what works for you, I want to bring up some. There was a brief thing that happened in the early '60s that changed the series briefly. Does anybody remember what that was?
Well, we already talked about Mason's surgery and being replaced for a few episodes.
No, not that. I'm talking about the when they had the young kid in the while.
Oh yeah, right.
There was a in an effort. This was during the youth movement sort of thing, and. They had a law student sort of working with them, and this was an effort to get people who, you know, he was cast there in the sort of the Fabian sort of looking thing because you know he had that he was this young kid, a law student, and he was just a background character. The one thing that was different about this, as opposed to, you know, characters brought in on the show for a brief period of time, he really never did that much of the show. And he just was there in the office and listening and then maybe would interview a client a little bit. But he didn't do a lot. He wasn't given that much to do. And so... That's pretty much the story there. They just tried to throw somebody in there who was a little younger to attract some people. And I'm trying to remember his name right now, and I'm blanking on it. So you have to give me a minute till my brain kicks in. I'm on a lot of painkillers tonight for my ankle's killing me.
Yep. It's a drug.
we all have our aches and pains. While you get a little better, let's go to something a little easier. If you had to choose like three episodes that kind of stand out for you, you don't necessarily have to come up with the name. You can just say it's the one where this happened, or you know, whatever. But like three memorable episodes for you. Let's start with you, Bill. Which if somebody said, give me three great Perry Mason episodes that you think I'd really enjoy too, which three would they be?
Well, obviously I don't remember the name, but the one where his doppelganger is probably number one.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one. There was one thing about they kept using the same location, desert location, just outside of L.A., where all the ranches were, where all the farms were, where all the oil wells were. And there was one episode with an oil well. I really liked it when they went out of L.A. and that episode, the trial was in this supposed town that's supposed to be in the middle of Southern California. And, I liked it when they got around a lot like that. And I like the earlier seasons in general for a weird reason, and that is, or at least I'm noticing this now, I like the cars better. You know, after about 1960, Mason and Drake drove those ubiquitous Cadillacs. I'm sorry, Lincoln Continentals. But the cars in the episodes in the 50s were much more interesting. And one of my favorite ones from that era is one of the Christian Nyby ones. I'm trying to think of was a nurse who runs away. There's a nurse's key to the case, and Drake doesn't find her till near the end.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that actually speaks to the fact that you don't necessarily remember the titles, but you damn sure remember the plot.
Right. Well, the episode where Perry played in another character was Dead Ringer in season 9. He played a drifter called Grimes.
The cars.
Now they had different contracts over the years. And they went from Lincoln and then briefly to Ford and everything. They had a lot of problems with the contracts that they switched off of the Fords because they had so much trouble with them. They had different contracts over different years, but you have to remember, this is one of the first shows you ever saw where somebody had a car phone.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
oh,
that really, really struck me when I watched it on MeTV.
Yeah. And they had, I think there was actually one episode where somebody had a record player in their car, which was not unheard of back then. There were some specially made outfitted cars back then that had the record players that would play a full album, or record players that had a would play just 45s that you could get, and these were in some of the larger models, and you could get them specially outfitted with that device. But having a phone in the car, of course, that eliminated them having to run to a payphone or something like that, knock
right,
on a neighbor's door.
Time consuming and distracting. Right.
Exactly. So they utilized the car phone way before any other show ever did, and it was, it was made it that much more very modern in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to bring up something about that people ask about a lot is, when Paul Drake went out that back door behind Perry's desk, where did it go? Actually, they addressed this in different episodes, in different seasons. There was one, most of the time it went to a back hallway, which led down to Paul's office, which you saw once or twice. And a couple other times, it went to another office or another room of some kind that people were in, which was very weird. But most of the time it was just a back hallway, and Paul would go down to his office with, just a convenient way for him to, to come into Perry's office. Now, Perry's office was, there's a book that talks about that I got years ago that had the architecture layouts for various homes of TV series, and Perry's office is one of the, it gave the layout. Now, the layout for the office is very unusual. You had Gertie's was the first office. Okay, that was the receptionist, which you saw only in a handful of episodes. And then you had Della's office. And then there was another office, and then there was Perry's. And Gertie's was the first one. But
right.
Now there was a law library that went off to the left from Gertie's office. And the law library was unique in the fact that it was basically a curved sort of office. And there was a door. The door went from Gertie's office or Della's office, and then around into Perry's office. So you could leave Perry's office and go out to Gertie's area, without being seen. Like, you wouldn't have to go through the main hallway. So a lot of times, they would stash a client into the law library, and they could then sneak out through the front door.
Yeah, especially when a drag was coming.
Right. If they saw a drag coming, they'd have the person, they'd hide him in the law library, then have him go out the other way, go out the side door to Gertie's office, and, it was just very convenient. They'd say, nope, you can look, nobody's here.
Well, there's actually one episode where Paul looked out the window in Perry's office and said, our friend's coming up the stairs, and Perry told his client, you better go out this door.
Yeah. So
exactly.
Yeah, and once you saw the layout that this guy did for the office, it made sense, how the client could sneak out without the police ever seeing him. And I don't think they ever caught on to that, that there were multiple doors of the law library. And also in the beginning, in the early episodes, Perry would put his hat on a bust by the door, but that didn't last very long. That was in some early episodes. He put his fedora on that bust, but things changed. Men stopped wearing hats, so, it didn't last.
Right. But I was going to say that if I had to, and just to get to me for mine, now we'll get back to this, but this has led to some great conversation. But if I, and then we'll get to you for this question, Alan, if I was to choose three episodes that I think are really good examples of Perry Mason, I would go with, I found the name of the episode I was looking for, the one that's really noirish. It's called The Case of the Moth-Eaten Mink.
That was an early one, yes.
Yep. Then there's The Case of the Nine Dolls, and The Case of, I believe it's The Case of the Cautious Coquette. And they're all earlier episodes. But those early episodes are just so drenched in noir goodness that you can't deny them. I mean, they're just so damn good. Although, if I had to cheat, I would probably add a fourth and say The Case of the Prudent Prosecutor is a lot of fun. But I'll let you, Alan, tell the audience why that's such a fun episode, and then you can answer what your three episodes would be.
I'm trying to remember the plot of that one, and you're killing me here because
that's the one where Hamilton Berger calls Perry Mason.
Okay, that's what I thought you related to. Okay. All right, and that episode starts out where Berger is at a fishing resort, and somebody turns up dead, and Hamilton Berger is the suspect. He calls in Perry to defend him because he's considered a suspect by the local police in this small town where the fishing hole is. It's a fishing lodge. And then Perry shows up, and Trag says, you know, to Perry, hello, you're not needed here, et cetera. And then Hamilton Berger walks up and says, Perry, I'm so glad you came. And then Trag does this great double take, and it's one of the – there's a funnier bit coming up. But he does this take where he goes, wait, you called him? And Trag just, like, shakes his head and, you know, it doesn't know what's going on and walks away.
I'm going back to the crime scene. He's walking back in the building.
But Perry then takes one of the witnesses who was there and talks, and, you know, and somebody, and the guys, and talks to this old man. And then Perry doesn't believe him, takes him back in the room again, and then does this accent thing. And I was trying to find the quote on the TV Elites page, and I can't, but he says in this accent, like, you know, talking like he's off the Beverly Hillbillies about, you know, and tells the guy, do you remember how the quote went? Because I cannot find it. And
it's something like he says, gold darn it or something. I remember that he gets real country.
Yeah. He gets really countrified on this guy. You know, and does this bit of shtick, which is the funniest thing in all 9 seasons. There's nothing funnier than Perry, you know, speaking in a country voice to this old man, you know, about how you're gonna tell me the truth. And that episode has the 2 funniest things in it that you could ever find. And you know, it's just fascinating to me.
Well, you know, the thing is the only thing that would have been better is if Trag would have said to Berger in another scene something along the lines of, do you want me to lose another arrest? You brought Mason onto the case? You're killing me here.
Yeah.
There's also an episode where I'm trying to remember the title and I'm not getting what I want, but there was a... They were filming a TV series, and somebody switched out a gun with blanks with a gun with real bullets, and somebody actually gets shot during the filming of the scene, and they call in. This is in the 9th season, I'm pretty sure. And they call in, you know, Perry, and all the background, everybody in the that is in the episode. As that works on the set, actually worked on the set of the show. So this
that's
is
the
like
final
a,
episode.
Yeah, they interview all these people, you know, from the prop man to the lighting guy and everything, and the cameraman. And these are all people that worked in the show. And they ask him if, you know, what they know about the murder and everything. And it's really a very nice thing, and a nice little wait. The final fade out is called from May of 66,
yep.
And this is just one of the better episodes. And you gotta love it for the fact that they knew they were gonna go off. They're pretty sure they were gonna go off the air, and they decided to bring the cast on camera and give them something to say and you know, and get an appearance. The other one in the 9th season that's very memorable is the 21st episode that was the only episode filmed in color. This was a in case they got renewed for a 10th season, they filmed an episode in color because the following year, starting with fall of 67, CBS was going to show everything in color because this was one of the last shows in black and white on TV was in the spring of 66. So the Twice Told Twist was filmed in color, and that's the only one.
Victor Buono was in that one.
A good one. I like a lot of the first two seasons more than, because they're more drenched in noir and the cars are bigger and everything. I want to talk about also the building we're in. It was the Brent building in the show, but it had started out as it belonged to a company called, I think, Superior Oil. And then it was later the Bank of California. Now, even though it was the Brent building, still, all during the show, there was a couple of scenes later in the series where they were filmed late at night. And they did a long tracking shot of Perry and Della getting out of a car going into the building. And you could see Bank of California, above the door, on an overhang. So, because it became a Bank of California building, and I think it's a hotel today. So it was, in the series, it was just called the Brent building, but what it really was during most of the series was Bank of California building. There were four episodes where Perry was substituted for because he was having surgery, and there were two other episodes where he was substituted for a couple of times. So one of my favorites was Betty Davis subbing for him.
That one was great. I almost listed that. She was fabulous.
Another one was when Mike Connors substituted for him, and I find very strange, but if you look under Mike Connors' resume, he played Mannix, but earlier in his career, he was listed he went by the nickname of Touch Connors. I gotta look up his history sometime and find out how he got that nickname, but he was listed as in quotes, Touch Connors, and then Michael Touch Connors. And then he dropped the touch because I don't know. I thought that was really an odd name to have back then. I don't know where that came from, of course, when Hamilton Berger was suspended, there were a lot of substitute DAs, which made it interesting too. So I think the one constant during the whole show was Della. Because there was when Perry was out the first time, they had filmed scenes in advance of him in a hospital room preparing for surgery.
Right.
But the second time, they didn't do that, and Della just said Perry had to fly off to Europe for a conference. And you wonder, why would an American lawyer have to go to Europe for a conference? That really that excuse was kind of flimsy, but, he did. I mean, it just... Okay, why would a California lawyer need to go to Europe for a law conference of some kind? It was very strange, but they did that too. And and there was a couple he just didn't appear in that Della covered for him on. So I guess you could say Della in every episode, and the only one probably that was.
One of the first four were... Raymond Burr was out. He was substituted by Hugh O'Brien, and that was a very espionage series. Episode.
Yeah.
That it almost watching it. Within the last couple of years again, it almost looked like a backdoor pilot for an espionage spinoff, starring Hugh O'Brien, because it was much more spycraft than it was legal.
Yeah, another one who was the guest attorney. We mentioned Betty Davis and Michael Rennie and Mike Connors and Hugh O'Brien. I want to also throw out there Walter Pidgeon was also a guest. Was a guest. So that's another one we should put that in.
Yep.
And Earl Stanley Gardner was in the last episode as uncredited as a judge, as a second judge. There were two judges shown in that episode. So the sponsorship for the automobiles went back between General Motors and Ford. And I can tell you now that they had more problems with the Fords than they did than anything else. But and Paul Drake liked to drive. I remember he drove some early Thunderbirds and later Corvette.
Yeah, those were gorgeous.
Yes. Well, I had a chance to buy, not to buy, but to drive a late 50s Thunderbird. It was a small convertible, and it was like the later Thunderbirds of the 70s I was used to seeing. Here you're driving a Thunderbird that is nothing like the others, but, you know, this friend of my sister's had one, and he let me drive it for a while, and I'm like, this is weird. I mean, you know, it was... That was driving a classic car like that was kind of cool. It was very cool. So I assume the
steering was very loose.
It was loose. It had a large steering wheel, and it was very loose steering. And then the thing was very fast. So
yeah.
You know,
that was the era of the suicide knob.
Yeah, it had. I don't think he had that on there.
No, I never saw that on the show. However, I had neighbors who had them.
Yes, I did. That was a little knob you put on the steering wheel to help you turn it, and those weren't a good idea, really.
Yeah, with one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to call it the suicide knob.
Oof. Well, yeah, the suicide doors on old Lincoln Continentals, you know, because they open from...
Yeah, opening backwards, right.
I had an English teacher who drove a 62 Continental, and, you know, that car was, I loved that car of his, and he drove, you know, the whole time I knew him, before I left Moments, he drove, that black Continental. I would tease him, and I would call it his hearse. You know, didn't look like a hearse, but to me it was, you know, something like an undertaker would drive.
Yeah. Very square, very serious.
I also want to throw in this because a lot of people might not know, you know, they're used to watching more modern TV, but a lot of shows back then, you see, nowadays, you know, people have to be read their rights, but that didn't start until the mid-60s, because before that, you didn't have Lieutenant Tragg reading anybody their rights or... And, you know, that more came into prominence with Joe Friday. Joe Friday was always, you have the right to remain silent, blah, 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 you know, and Adam 12. But before 66...
Well, that was based on a famous court case, right?
Yep, Miranda case.
It's a very, right. Our Arizona court. That's why it's called the Miranda rights.
Right.
So I had somebody say to me, like, that show's stupid. Nobody ever gets read their rights. I'm like, they didn't have to read their rights back then. There were no Miranda rights before the 66 or 67. And it looked like, there weren't? No.
There was a TV movie about the Miranda case with Telly Savalas.
And I told the guy, I said, there were no zip codes before the mid-50s either. What? No, zip code was a 50s thing, you know? And there was like, you know, people assumed that everything was forever. I had gotten into an argument about somebody saying, you know, I was telling him that money in the, before 1920, a lot of paper money was larger. And it was. The bills were bigger back then. And that's why it used to be called folded money, because you had to fold it to put it in your pocket, because the bills were larger. And I said, yeah, the money was larger, you know, during the, after the turn of the century, and then they got smaller. And they're like, what? And I said, look it up. And it just, you know, people don't, you know, they think everything's always been the same, and that's not quite the truth.
Yeah, right.
So, Let's see. You also had, I'll tell you an odd one. Neil Hamilton played Commissioner Gordon on Batman. Yvonne Craig, who played Bat, was his daughter in that episode. Later, of course, they were both on, you know, so they were in Perry Mason together. But later on, when they were reunited for Batman, Neil Hamilton didn't remember her being with him on Perry Mason. I don't know if he was losing his memory or what, but he didn't recall her being working with her before.
Hmm.
There you go.
That's
the story I've heard that Yvonne Craig told later on, that Neil Hamilton didn't remember her. So, yeah, you know, there you go. And Adam West was on an episode. Was going to be on an episode, but I... Oh, yeah, Adam West did do an episode. Yes, he did. Paul... Wasn't Robert Redford on an episode, too?
He might have been.
I think Redford was an early episode, also. Yeah. So you had a lot of people were on those early episodes.
But you know, I have a friend that does not quite like Perry Mason. They've said to me that it's a bad show with an all-time theme. And one of their complaints was the way that, quote, Dulles Street gets reduced to nothing but a fetching secretary. And I want to know what show they're watching because, folks, guys, I mean, is it just me or was Della not actually one of the more developed female characters on television during the 50s?
She had dialogue that meant something. You know, she wasn't just there for eye candy. I mean, if that's the case, she would have walked in, you know, did a sexy turn and walked out. But no, she was essential. She was like, she stayed up late with them. She went out to dinner with them. They weren't romantic, but she was, and she discovered clues and she helped clients. There was a lot more going on with Dulles Street. Obviously the person hasn't watched that many episodes, or maybe he watched only the later TV movies and thought that, but no, that's not even the case. No, nothing like that.
No, I have no idea where that's coming from. I never had that impression. Watching it first run or recently, never had that impression.
Yeah, I always thought Della was awesome. You know, Della was practically, I mean, the thing is, she was not just a secretary. She was his legal assistant. She was basically a paralegal.
Right. The rarely seen Gertie was more the secretary because she was the reception secretary. You saw her in 6 or 10 episodes. I don't know. But, you know.
Yeah, the older lady with the severe haircut. Yep.
You know, but basically Della was much more. And because she would, you know, she knew what she was doing when she talked to people. She wasn't given fluff dialogue. She was a serious character.
I mean, you know, the thing is, the episodes that I watched, there were a couple times where Della would bring Perry some pieces of paper, and Perry would say, "Did you have a chance to go over those documents, Della?" And she'd say, "Yes, I did, Perry." He said, "Can you figure it out? Because I'm stumped." And more than once, Della would say, "Well, it occurs to me this, this, or that." I mean, Della was no dummy. And, you know, Della was always the one taking care of anybody's kids that came along, but not just because she was a woman, but because she was actually caring. I mean, this is a person who was allowed to be a woman and yet be successful at her job, which was incredibly rare in the 50s. I think Della actually deserves a lot more credit as, I'll say it, a bit of a 50s feminist icon. She should be.
Mm. Yeah, definitely there. I agree with you on that.
And you know, Barbara Hale definitely had something to do with that by insisting on
on Della not just being a pair of legs, as she put it.
Yeah, like Mary Tyler Moore, you know, on that one. You always ever saw her legs.
The dress was also very professional.
Yeah. Like I said, she mm-hmm. wasn't there on a piece. If they wanted her to be, you know, whatever your friend says, she would have been blonde and wore a ton of makeup, but, you know, she wasn't anything like that. She was the quintessential perfect secretary in the sense that she was more than a secretary and smart as hell. So, you know, I'll give her credit for that. And
yep.
We also got to talk about Paul Drake for a minute because that character was amazing. You know, you gotta give it to that show with him because he wasn't just he didn't see one thing people said, oh, he worked for Perry. No, he didn't just work for Perry. He worked for himself.
No, he had his own practice. He brought Perry a couple of cases.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, more than once. I mean, I one of the episodes I watched, this guy came in and gave Paul a case, and Paul was like, shit, I'm being set up. And he bumped into Perry in that hallway, and Perry said, where are you running off to? He said, the bank. And maybe jail if this is what I think it is. I mean, you know, Paul was his own guy. I think Paul was accused of murder in one episode, pretty sure he was, that
yeah.
he got arrested, that they thought he killed somebody and Perry had to defend him. So, you know, there's a lot. And you know, yes, he worked for Perry, but he wasn't exclusive to Perry. Somebody told me he was, and I said, where did you ever get that idea? I said, that's not even close to true.
Well, I had a feeling they were, you know, collaborators. They were social equals, you know.
Yeah, they
yep.
they were friends in some respect, you know, and, you know, but Paul got
well,
a lot of work.
One of the best lines in the whole show was when Hamilton Berger said, how come you don't come over to our side, Drake, and Paul looked at him and said, you can't afford my rates.
Yeah, that's true. Speaking of rates, you know, I don't think they said his rate much, but Perry sometimes worked for Nichols because, you know, an older person or a child would come in and try to hire him and give him a few dollars, and Perry would take the case, you know. He wasn't,
yeah, like the kid in the case of the nine dolls where he just wanted to help that girl find her family.
Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, Matlock. You had that 10 grand or you couldn't do it, you know, or was it 10 grand or 100 grand? He was expensive.
It was 100,000.
Yeah, and, you know, Matlock always wanted the big bucks, but Perry was solid enough in his career, you know, that he could afford to take on those near pro bono sort of cases. And a lot of people don't realize this, but a lot of the trials were never actual jury trials. They would, a lot of the confessions.
They were evidentiary
would come
hearings. They were preliminary hearings, right?
Yes, they were actuary hearings and not, they hadn't even gotten to the jury trial yet. So you know, a jury trials would have meant hiring more extras and everything else. So you'd have these preliminary hearings, actuary hearings, you know, sometimes evidence hearings, and there were and that's what was going on. And then people would, you know, things would come up then, and then person would get found out, you know, through some method. But you rarely saw an actual jury in a pair of cases. I don't think you did. I can't remember too many. That many
out of the dozen or so that I watched, I only saw a jury once, and it knocked me for a loop. I was like, wait, what?
Well, that's the one where Perry's client was actually found guilty, and then he found them innocent later on. I know that because the guilty verdict came down in one episode.
Yep.
And,
I think there were juries. I think there were juries in a few episodes, but they tended not to be in the Los Angeles Superior Court. Some of the episodes that I mentioned before that took place in like towns in, you know, in the middle of bleeping nowhere in Southern California, they had juries.
They would go to these. Perry would be at a resort and somebody would get killed and, you know, and he'd have to represent him, you know. Perry would be on vacation somewhere. I mean, the man got called into business in wherever he went, you know.
I mean, every time Perry tried going fishing, something happened. I mean, he's getting ready to go to Scotland for fishing. A little girl walks in. He goes out to his favorite lake. And he damn near witnesses a murder on the far side of the lake, you know?
Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
Yep. So,
I mean, you know, but it's just a really good show that I think people are starting to forget about, maybe because it's so ubiquitous, maybe because it's become such a part of the cultural landscape, because the show started in 57. You know, so this is a show that's over 60 years old, that ran a long time, was in reruns forever, had, another 7 or 8 years of TV movies that brought it to a new generation. And I think people just kind of take it for granted. It's kind of like wallpaper for a lot of people.
Well, also, people had 20 years of Law and Order, which, you know, was different and almost, well, I guess always had a jury trial at the end, you know. But I'll tell you what really turns people, a lot of people, away from the show, and this is one thing that I, when I talk to people, is, black and white. They don't want to watch a black and white series, you know.
Yeah.
I had a guy that would say, like, whenever you look at Showtime at 2 in the morning, it's an old black and white crap movie. And I'm like, some of the best movies ever were black and white. What are you talking about? You know, and they won't watch it because it's in black and white. I find that really bizarre, you know, and it's like saying I won't do a country music song because there's no drums on it.
It's also fairly slow. There is not a lot of action. You know, there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of character, but it's not an up-tempo show. I mean, it's not even, you know, not anywhere near the intensity of say, The Untouchables. But that's one of the things I like about it, and that's one of the things that bothered me about the 1980s, early 90s TV movies, is that they lost that, you know, kind of deliberative way that the show unfolded. To me, that's a feature, not a bug. But, you know, you look at somebody who's grown up on those 80s, 90s movies that I hated, you know, Perry Mason or Matlock or, you know, some of those other things, and, you know, and they just can't slow the mental clock down to be able to pay attention to this as it gradually unfolds, you know, and you really have to pay attention because everything means something. I mean, everything has some significance, you know, which is why at the end Perry is always able to uncover, you know, the true culprit at exactly 5 minutes before the show ends.
Yep.
And while that was the case, I still, you know, even though, which, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, that you could do the same thing with House. And you watch the old House show, and, you know, they would, I used to do it, my wife would watch it, and I'd listen to it in the background. I wouldn't watch the episode. I'd be doing something else. And then later on, you know, because it was on DVR, I would watch the first 15 minutes and then the last 10, and then that's all you needed because, you know, everything in between was, you know, you're yelling, is it lupus? You know, and that was pretty much it, you know?
Yep. Now, another friend of mine compared Perry Mason
to Diagnosis Murder and said that he thinks that Diagnosis Murder owes more than a little bit to Perry Mason. What do you guys think?
I never watched it.
I watched it, but I can't agree with that, really. I'd say it follows a Diagnosis Murder has its own formula, but I don't think it's quite the same thing.
Yeah, I was going to say it's definitely one of those shows that's very faithful to its formula, like Perry Mason was, and executed it perfectly every week, whether or not you liked it.
Yeah. But,
is that the one with Dick Van Dyke?
Yep.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good show.
I saw a handful of episodes.
Well, what I have is they did a series of movies, and I have a DVD set of the movies that the show produced, but not the series itself. It's something that I toyed with buying a couple times, but never got around to it.
Yeah.
So.
Then
you know, I mean, people.
Yeah, I wasn't watching TV much in those days.
They want everybody to watch, you know, everybody wants to see a car chase and a gunfight, you know, and, you know, if you wanted a car chase, you watch Mannix and Cannon and, you know, some of those other things. But if you,
you want a car chase, I'll watch Mad Max. I don't want a car chase in my TV shows.
You know, that's
something
I have to say. We were talking about how, you know, the TV movies in the 80s and 90s changed for Perry Mason, but... everybody talks about how Hill Street Blues was such a different cop show compared to everything that had come before, except for one aspect. Almost every single episode for a while there felt like it had a car chase in it. And that's something that I have to say, the later Homicide: Life on the Street, I really appreciated. I think in all of Homicide, there was one episode that had a car chase, and it was mostly played for laughs, and it was very, very, very Homicide. So you know,
yeah, I completely agree. I am, you know, it's a cliche that, you know, unless it's done exceptionally well, I have no patience with.
Yeah,
I'm with you on Mad Max. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm one that likes all four films, even though I think Fury Road is
so
a bunch.
Yeah, if I want a car chase, I know what to go for, but you know, I'll look at Freebie and the Bean and, you know, and Fear is the Key, but I won't, I certainly won't, you know, the car chase, it's okay. There are some good ones, but you don't need that in every, I don't turn on TV show to say, I'm going to watch a car chase. You know,
no.
I turn on a TV show to be, you know, more intellectually stimulated by a mystery. And if I want a mystery, I'm going to watch Perry Mason because, yeah, you know, it's fun to figure out, you know, when my wife, I binge watched the show myself, but when my wife was still around, you know, I didn't remember every episode. I had seen probably every episode even before I did the binge watching. But she'd say, you remember who the killer was? And we try to make a guess. Sometimes it was obvious and sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah, that's the thing. Usually with Perry Mason, right around the time that Perry closes in is usually the time that I start closing in. And that's part of why I say it's such a tightly plotted show. But the only episode that I can ever remember who the killer is as soon as it starts is the one that has Leonard Nimoy, because, well,
yeah,
you know, but
yeah.
I want to ask a question before we wrap this up. What do you guys see as the lasting legacy of Perry Mason? What do you think its real influence on television has been? And I'll start with you, Bill.
I don't think it's that influential anymore. I think shows like Hill Street and Homicide, you know, have changed the landscape so much that I don't see any Perry Mason DNA, you know, like in any of the mysteries I watch, any of the Nordic noir or the, you know, there was just something about it that was so much of its time. And, you know, as I've said, I love watching it and rewatching it, but I don't think there's much of its DNA left in today's TV.
Yeah. So what about you, Alan?
Well, I have to agree with that, because lawyer shows back then, you know, Perry was always about a murderment, you know, somebody being was usually about somebody being killed or some other, but, or if it wasn't that, it would lead into somebody being killed. Nowadays, you know, it's either you're watching shows about, you know, the prosecutor, Law and Order, or you get shows like The Good Wife and Allie, what's it?
Allie McBeal.
Allie McBeal, you know, and Law and Order. And rather than murder, those lawyers were defending, you know, people arrested for other crimes, white-collar crimes, you know, or something along, or you know, or contesting wills or something. They weren't, you know, you weren't getting people being, you know, you didn't have Harry Hamlin defending a lot of murder suspects. He was doing divorce cases, you know, and then
yep.
and then sleeping with the clients on top of that. So, you know, lawyer shows didn't follow the Perry formula as much. They steered away from that and went to where the lawyer was either a prosecutor, or they were a criminal lawyer and more of a general lawyer, you know, dealing with blue collar crime and not as much. You know, I can't think. I'm trying to think of another one where the lawyer was defending murderers a lot. There weren't that many of them, if any, that had come to, you know.
Boston Legal which is the first one? But I think the first one was Boston
the
Public.
The Practice was first, and then Boston Legal after.
Right.
Yeah,
practice,
yeah, Boston
practice.
Legal, would you know, there were a lot of murders in that.
There were some in Boston Legal and such, but most shows with lawyers steered away from the strict murder every week aspect. And Perry, even though Perry had that formula down, I think a lot of shows didn't follow it because they were afraid of being called, oh, it's just another Perry Mason imitator. So, that's why it's so good. It was so good that nobody wanted to imitate it except Perry Mason themselves when they brought it back in TV movies.
Yeah, there's another, I think, major difference between Perry Mason and lawyer shows today, which is something that tends to bother me a lot, and that so much of the time and energy is expended in the interpersonal relationships, you know, among the people in the law practice, you know, and who they're sleeping with and what problems they're having in their marriage, you know, and it's not a, you know, Perry Mason was about the mystery.
Yep.
Yeah. You rarely saw Perry at home. As he was there just about to go to bed when a client would call him, you know, and, you know, I don't think every apartment might be used to stash a witness, but that's pretty much it. It was really about.
Yeah, I think the most we ever saw of Perry or Paul's place was when one of them or a client, either they called the other or a client called them, and you saw them roll out of bed and go, oh, okay, I'll be there in a little while.
Right. Yeah, that was it. And then they were wherever the client was.
Yep.
Yeah. They didn't really, you know, you didn't have Perry sleeping with a famous actress, Perry dating. Perry didn't, you know, date anyone on the show. He'd go out to dinner with Della and maybe a client or two and Paul, but that was pretty much it. And, you know, you didn't get into Perry's love life or Della's love life or Paul Drake's love life, which I think really was a good thing for the show, because that would have taken a – let me tell you this. If you don't remember, when the FBI series started with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., the first couple seasons, especially the first one, they tried to show some of the agents at home with their families. Well, that didn't work. It didn't go down well with viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a criticism of the show. And by season 3 and 4, you never saw those guys at home again. They were all
well, remember, the same thing happened with Barney Miller. The early episodes of Barney Miller, they had Barney at home with his wife, and I think there was a kid. And after that, you heard
they
about dropped
that
occasionally,
like a hot,
but that was it.
Yeah.
Which is good. I mean, I prefer it when a show focuses on the work. You know, I mean, some relationship drama is okay because you need to show these people are human, you know, and it probably has never been done as well as on The Wire, but, you know, just too much drama really turns me off. It's why I don't watch, you know, a lot of medical shows, because, you know, the relationship drama distracts from the medicine.
Yeah,
I want to see the
world.
And the early episodes of ER really did a good job balancing that, but eventually, you know, ER was so popular for so long that it that ABC decided they wanted their own version of ER, only they were going to soap it up and focus less on emergency room stuff, and they went and created Grey's Anatomy. And Grey's Anatomy was so popular in its first season that NBC said, well, the ratings are sliding on ER. We've got to be more like Grey's Anatomy. So ER became even more like the show that it had influenced.
Yeah, I've never been a fan
by the end
of
Grey's
Anatomy, and that, I mean, that turned me off from the get-go.
I hate Grey's Anatomy. First episode, and have never watched it since, and look how long it's been on, but I still can't stand it, and I refuse to watch.
No, I watched the first episode and barely got through it. Sorry, folks. I know there's got to be some Grey's Anatomy fans out there, but it's just not my cup of tea. But no, nor mine.
I'm a guy that liked Medical Center. That was my show. So, you know.
Yep. So, is there anything we want to say about this show before we sign off? So, Bill, is there anything you want to say about Perry that we haven't covered yet?
Something occurred to me like half an hour or so ago when we were talking about the phones in the car, and you mentioned the record players. I think, you know, and this is, this is something that occurred to me much more watching it on MeTV, you know, in recent years. I think the show did a really good job of showing particular muse. Like, I remember there was one show about a jazz drummer, you know, and it showed, you know, and there were scenes set in a jazz bar, and, you know, there was musicians talking in it, and I think they did a much better job than almost any other show I can think of, certainly much better than Dragnet, which I think was the nadir of, showing any kind of cultural, I don't want to call it counterculture, because that means the 60s, but, you know, beatniks, jazz, you know, anything like that. Mason did that very, very well.
Mm-hmm. I think the Mason beatnik episode also, didn't he? Where they went like to a, you know, like went to a beatnik club.
Yep.
Am I wrong about that? I seem to remember they did that.
Seems vaguely familiar. It wasn't one of the episodes I watched as prep for the show, but I definitely remember, I want to say Perry, Della, and Paul all went to this beatnik bar to meet with a client.
There was one.
Yeah,
I
remember that episode because, you know, being me, when something like that happens, I immediately perk up and pay more attention.
Yeah. Yeah, there was really some, you know, they were all over the place. You know, you had rich clients, you had poor clients, you had elderly clients, you had little children walk in now and then. You know,
you had Ilya Shuriakin.
They didn't shy away from anything. Oh, and I mentioned in the beginning, you know, that, and I still didn't find his name, but that act, that character who was like the Fabian character, he didn't last very long. I don't even think he was on a whole season. But, you know, he was just eye candy there, you know, as a visiting law student of sorts, and I guess internship, you might call it. And thankfully, he didn't stay around very long. You know, he was like the old and happy days. He just got he went off to college and died in the football field.
Yep. So Alan, any final thoughts for yourself on the show?
It's still in my top three of all time, right up there with the Avengers, and probably Person of Interest. I know it's more modern, but you know, I'm really a fan of that show too. So,
well, you know, that's actually really cool. You know what? We'll have to do an episode. We'll have to get the three of us together if we can figure out the timing, because I definitely want to cover Person of Interest, because damn, if that's not a great show.
Yeah, I'd be up for that.
I haven't watched all of, I've only piecemealed seasons, the last two seasons. I would need to sit down and watch seasons 4 and 5.
Wonderful finale, endgame for that show.
I know, but I'm not.
Yeah, it really was.
As I should be. I'll tell you another show we should do. Justified. Has everyone seen that?
I've only seen the first few episodes. It's one I've got to watch more of.
Who was in that? Matthew McConaughey. Somebody who irritates me was in
that. No, the one with McConaughey was True Detective.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he irritates me. But
Justified is not is different. That was See how my brain works today. Timothy Oliphant was the lead in that, and
who was also in Deadwood.
Yeah, I remember I sat down and watched the first episode, thinking I would hate it, and I was absolutely blown away by how good that show was. Man, that show was good.
It's a great show from what I've seen of it, but so we have pretty much covered everything. And for the Deviant Legion network, I'm going to say that Carl is going to be unavailable for a few weeks. He's got some cool things going on, and because of that, I can announce that tonight is the first of 6 straight weeks that I'm going to be doing this show. And next week's show is going to be an episode about the CBS Saturday Night Comedy lineup and how it seemed to lead into the rise of these appointment night blocks like the Fox Sunday, HBO Sunday, ABC Fridays, and especially NBC Thursdays. So you still up for that one, Alan?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yep. We'll definitely be doing that next week. And
I didn't know CBS had a Saturday Night Comedy block.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, it was a heck of a block. I forget exactly which order it went in. Actually, let me look. I remember those series.
You know me in U.S. sitcoms.
It was All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, and then the Carol Burnett Show. For one or two seasons, MASH moved away mid-season, and the Jeffersons came in.
So,
I remember that now. I think I watched Newhart and Carol Burnett, but that was it.
Yep.
Would never miss. I had to watch Carol Burnett every night. I couldn't miss that one. And I like the. I'm more into the second Newhart show than I am the first one, but I still watched every episode. And I usually watched All in the Family. But yes.
We'll be getting to that next week then.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank you guys for coming on. And I want to thank our listeners.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. It definitely was a pleasure. So let's say goodnight and sign off. And see you all next time. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, Gracie.
Bye.
Bye.
Good night, Dave.